Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. It seems like Minnesota here tonight. The temperatures are in the high 40s on this Friday night. Today, we'll be chatting with our friend from Minnesota, Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor. We're going to take a look at these elections in Canada. We'll look at the elections in the United States. We'll focus on the Democrats and then look at President Trump. So let me say hello to our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor up in Minnesota. Barry, it feels like Minnesota here. 47, 48 degrees in North Texas today, Barry.
Hace frío, sí.
That's right, that's right. Hace mucho frío, as they say.
But it's a little warmer up here, but we're going to be cold. We're preparing for a cold winter.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of time up there. Although I checked the temperatures in like Green Bay and up in that direction, it was pretty cold the other day.
Well, the only thing we've got going for us is El Nino. And if this is an El Nino year, and it might be, then of course that produces warmer than usual temperatures. But
yeah,
the Farmer's Almanac predicted colder than usual. So you never know who's right.
No, you never know. You have to wait until about January 15th and then take stock of all the predictions by then. But it is, I mean, this turned out to be a cold and rainy day here in North Texas. Well, lots to get into, Barry. Talk about Canada, talk about the Democrats, and talk a little bit about President Trump. So take a look at our politics up here. But why don't we begin with Canada? I thought that was a very interesting election. I learned something in these elections up in Canada. I learned that you can be elected prime minister while not winning the popular vote. Then, of course, I realized that's a parliamentary system up there. They don't actually vote directly for the president. The parties elect the prime minister, but that was a very interesting election. Give me your thoughts on it, Barry.
Well, as you know, the Conservative Party won the popular vote, but really did much poorer in the election of seats because of the way their votes were distributed. They really dominated in the western provinces, the Conservatives did, but that's not where all the population is. Much of the population is in Ontario and Quebec. The reason the Prime Minister, Mr. Trudeau, didn't win a majority was he lost a lot of seats in Quebec, his native state, to the Quebec Separatist Party. And they made the biggest gains of all. But unlike in Israel, where you must get a majority of the parliament there, the Knesset, in order to be the leader of the country, to be the prime minister. In Canada, you can govern as a minority party and just try and put together coalitions for each individual vote in the legislative process.
Mm-hmm.
But that's highly risky because if you get a vote of no confidence, you've got a problem.
Right.
So But most of the parties in Canada lean to the left, and the Liberal Party, which he's the leader, is a left-of-center party. and even the Quebec Party, which its main issue is, you know, independence for Quebec. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, they are leaning to the left as well. And the only real major center-right party is the Conservative Party, and they only won 122 seats, and you had to have 170 seats or 171 to control the to be the governing party.
Now, I had always, I mean, I had understood that the, you know, the parliament or the seats were distributed related to population. So is that what you're saying, why, how, you know, the Conservative Party, I guess what I'm saying is, how could the Conservative Party get a higher percentage of the vote? And it was not by much. I think it was like 34-33. So it wasn't a big difference. But how could they get, you know, a higher percentage of the vote than the Liberal Party and not have more seats in the parliament?
Well, it's very simple.
How does it work? Explain it.
They won their races with much larger margins.
Okay.
So if you think of it in the inverse of what happened in the U.S., so the Democratic Party controls as large margins in New York, California, Illinois, and Massachusetts, whereas the Republicans won with smaller margins in a bunch of Midwestern states. So the actual popular vote went to the Democrats, but Donald Trump is the president. So it's really the reverse of in Canada, where it's the Conservative Party has actually got more votes, but the way the votes are distributed, they didn't win more seats. If you think of the winning of the seats as analogous to the Electoral College,
okay,
you can figure it out.
No, it makes sense now. It makes a lot of sense when you explain it that way, because I was thinking of the seats more in terms of like the House of Representatives. I mean, the House of Representatives is technically divided into 435 districts of somewhat equal population. But that's not quite the way it is up north, I guess, Barry.
Well, no, they're separated by a certain population. Again, the point is, for example, the Republicans could technically win more votes for Congress and still lose the control. Because, again, it's all about the margin you win for each seat. And as I pointed out, the Conservative Party won big margins. They won every seat, actually, in the West, in, you know, Manitoba, British Columbia, Alberta, and all those states. But they,
yeah, Alberta was huge. The conservative margins out there were incredible.
So, but whereas the margins were narrower in Quebec and Ontario, and some of the eastern provinces, and of course then you had the other party, because you have, in addition to the Quebec Party, you had a sort of a socialist party, and you have a Green Party, which won actually one seat. But it's all about apportioning your vote to either to a seat in Parliament in Canada or to an Electoral College vote in the U.S.
Right.
So it's not one on one. It's not a popular vote election.
Right. Exactly. I just didn't know that. I guess that was my point. Before the election, I didn't know that's how Canada did it. Now, it was, and that's what I was saying, that I learned a great deal from reading your article about how that election came down. Now, based on your article that you just wrote about Canada, the Prime Minister Trudeau seems to have a couple of ways he can go. He may not have a choice which way he goes, but one way could be that he tries to put together coalitions.
He's not going to put a coalition together.
No, I know. I understand. But if he goes purely minority, he's going to have a hard time getting anything done. And I'll just give you an example, climate change. He's having a lot of, I mean, the climate change, politics about climate change and implementing climate change, that's getting a lot of resistance from some of the Western provinces. because they're just saying out there, hey, you know, we slow down. We cannot go that fast on implementing a lot of these things.
It's going to mean a much more moderate, centrist agenda than he would have been able to accomplish, or he did accomplish when he had 177 votes, approximately six more than a majority. And so he could, you know, it's like in the U.S., of course, we have two bodies. So the Democrats control the House, but they can't get anything through into law because the Republicans control the Senate and the White House. So it's a stalemate.
Right.
And that's one of the things I've been writing about, is that all over the world, not just Canada, not just Israel, not just the U.S., not just Britain, but almost everywhere in democratic states and in totalitarian. I mean, there's a stalemate in Hong Kong facing the Chinese government, and there's a stalemate in Venezuela facing the, you know, the dictator in Venezuela, because it seems like, and I tie it into a universal or worldwide or global transformation taking place, affecting voters and affecting citizens who want more than they've had.
Mm-hmm.
The politicians are not delivering. Politicians tend to act very slow and in a way that doesn't produce results. But
right.
Conditions are demanding results. And there are conditions not only man-made, but natural. Natural disasters are providing situations that require governments to respond. And if governments don't respond, they're in trouble.
That's right.
Even if they're totalitarian. That's one of the problems for China, is even though everyone thinks it's just a totalitarian state, but if Xi doesn't respond to floods or natural disasters in internal China, he's got a problem.
He sure does. He sure does. I what you said, you know, this article that you wrote about stalemate, and I know you've written quite a few things like that lately. But I hear that, you know, I have, you know, as you probably know, Texas is full of Canadians. Now, a lot of the Canadians are Western Canadians, you know, from the provinces west. But because of the oil, you know, Texas and Alberta have a very close relationship. And you talk to these Canadians down here, and they're very unhappy with the taxes and the regulations in Canada. You know, they're just unhappy with it. They think that they're overtaxed. They're paying a lot more for taxes than what they're getting from government. That's what I'm hearing, whether that's representative of just the people I'm talking to, if there's a larger point there, I don't know. But what I hear from these Canadians down here is, hey, we're paying too much in taxes, and we want more freedom. We want less regulation in our businesses and in our personal lives, Barry.
Well, Canada is more of a welfare state, more of a European-style welfare state than the U.S. is. And even though the U.S. is very big, our taxes are relatively low compared to the rest of the world. And we don't provide universal health care. We don't provide other things that some of the European and countries like Canada do for their citizens. So it's a trade-off. And that's, of course, so the more conservative Westerners in Canada are probably much more akin to Texas than they are to Manitoba or Alberta.
Right. No, it's just fascinating. You're right, what's happening around the world. But where do you see, you know, one of the things you mentioned in your when you were talking about Canada a minute ago was a confidence vote. Could Prime Minister Trudeau face a confidence
well,
vote?
Well, I'm not
and
sure
lose?
What happens. He could face a non-confidence vote, and theoretically, if the members of the parliament wanted to put together a vote, they could remove him as prime minister. But I don't know exactly how that operates. but it's a risk he takes. Whereas, unless you're impeached in the U.S., you're president for 4 years. And that's like Macron in France has a four-year election. And even though he's incredibly unpopular right now, his numbers are in the high 20s, low 30s, even though he doesn't have to worry about losing his office because he can't be removed except, again, by impeachment, whatever the French equivalent is. So, and of course, that's why the Democrats are trying to impeach Donald Trump, because they, and we'll discuss that later, they still haven't gotten over 2016, and here it is almost 2020 and the new election, and they're trying to undo 2016.
Right, and we're going to get into, we'll talk about that in a minute when we come south of the border, but I just have another question and just another thought about Canada. Prime Minister Trudeau, of course, was sort of the darling of the left, you know, a couple of years ago. He's not that anymore. I just don't know how much he's going to be able to get done. I mean, I have a funny feeling that it's, like you say, a more centrist Trudeau, but that probably will end up being pretty boring for him because he's, I think, you know, he would rather have a liberal majority, but the Canadian voters didn't want that, and so if he doesn't govern from the center, he may very well face a vote of confidence. But let me ask you one quick question that I want to ask you about. There is a French Canadian party, I guess a Quebec party, that whose mission is to make Quebec an independent country. We've been hearing about that for a long time. Is that a realistic possibility? I mean, a lot of my Canadian friends are in two camps. One camp says, let them go. They're, you know, we don't like them anyway. Let them become an independent country. And then, of course, you have the others who say, no, they're part of Canada. We cannot let them go. But I mean, is there a possibility that this Quebec party could become so important that it could actually separate from Canada, Barry?
Well, they had a referendum and narrowly it was decided that they would not leave, mm-hmm. because even the Quebecois, the Quebecers themselves, are divided. The problem is most of the industry is in other parts of Canada, and most of the resources, even though Quebec is very large. And Quebec on its own, it would be like, if you recall, many years ago, Czechoslovakia divided mm-hmm. in two, into the Czech Republic and Slovakia. And a lot of people warned Slovakia, you're doing that at your peril because most of the industry is in the Czech Republic. And that's exactly what happened. The Czech Republic has been more prosperous, and the Slovakian state nation has had to do a lot of catch-up, and it's still not there. Now the reverse is true in Spain, where most of the industry in Spain is located in Catalonia. So mm-hmm. if Catalonia separates, they're okay. They've got a good economic base. But, of course, the rest of Spain can't let that happen. So we have these secessionist movements, and we in the United States, of course, should be very understanding because we had one ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It ended up with a thing called the Civil War, and we settled that question. Even though there is now talk of California seceding from the Union. And apparently, technically, California is one of, along with Texas, is one of the two states which technically could secede legally because of the way when they became states in the United States, there was an agreement. Texas, as you know, as you well know, was a republic mm-hmm. just prior to becoming a state. So these movements exist all over the world. They're all over Europe, in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Italy. Venice wants to be an independent country.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got all these movements going on in the world. they aren't very likely to happen. They're possible. As part of the instability which exists worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because one more note about this, and we'll take a break, and then we'll talk about American politics. But down in Brazil, there's talk of either the southern part of Brazil. You know, several of the states, including Sao Paulo, in the southern part of the very prosperous and more rich part of Brazil, there's talk of them, you know, separating from the rest of the country. Again, these things are not going to happen. They make for a lot of good conversation, but they're not going to happen. But I guess one last thought about Canada before we take a break. I think the Canadians will never split because there's no way they're going to. What are they going to do with those two Canadian hockey teams in the National Hockey League? I mean, where are those teams? What's going to happen to them? They want to be able to play Toronto and some of the other cities. So
and the
I
baseball
guess
teams.
The baseball team and they're in. I think it's very very likely that Montreal gets another baseball team here in the next 3 to 4 years. There's a lot of talk about that. So I'm sure that Canada will remain the way it is for a while. But that last election up there was very interesting, and I really appreciate the article that you wrote about it. I'm going to put a link of the article on the show information. Well, it's actually already linked because I have a link to your blog, to the Prairie Editor, that is. So it'll be on there for anybody who wants to see it. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk to our friend Barry about the Democrats and President Trump. Music of my good friend Carlos Guedes, and we have a link to the website that has his schedule around town, as well as his website where you can get a copy of this CD that we play the music on our show. Let's get back to our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. We also have a link, as we always do, to the Prairie Editor on the show information. Barry, you know, let's talk about President Trump first, because, you know, I find it so interesting when I talk to people from other countries, they're all so negative about President Trump, or they're not negative about President Trump, but they hear so many negative things about President Trump in the international coverage. And yet President Trump is in a stronger political position than most, I would say, of the top 10 leaders in the world, let's say in the democracies in the world. He has the strongest political position of all of them. I mean, he is very likely going to be reelected with numbers much bigger than Trudeau in Canada. You mentioned Macron in France, how unpopular he is. I mean, you can go down the list. And President Trump is in a stronger political position than any of those other world leaders. But yet you wouldn't believe that. Or, you know, when you talk to people from other countries, you know, they keep telling you what a bad position President Trump is in. It's weird, Barry. I just don't know how to figure it out, Barry.
Well, first of all, I don't know if I fully agree with you that Trump's reelection is so secure. It's certainly gotten improved a great deal since the Democrats have opted for the strategy of trying to impeach him. That certainly helps him. But the president's numbers, and I don't believe the polls at all, I think they understate his support. But nevertheless, we have to recall he barely won the election in 2016. The Electoral College was hefty, but a few thousand votes in a few states, and he doesn't win, and he didn't win the popular vote. And then in 2018, in those states he did win in the Midwest, he didn't do very well. Now, he wasn't on the ballot, and there's no question his popularity with his base is as strong or stronger than ever. Those rallies he has are unique, and are much bigger than any of the Democrats' rallies, even Elizabeth Warren's or even Bernie Sanders' latest one. He had 25,000. Trump gets 40, 50,000 total, and half of them outside the venue because they can't fit them in. But the president's reelection is not a certainty. But it's becoming much more likely thanks to the Democrats, because I think the Democratic Party is much more divided than the Republican Party. It's split into two main wings, a sort of center-left party, liberal, that supports mostly Joe Biden, more moderate and the more traditional liberal party. It's still a left of center party and very liberal, but it's certainly not where the far left wing part of the socialist wing led by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren is at. And those two wings are fighting it out, and I'm beginning to think now, I'm going to say it now on your show, that I think that the Democratic convention next July could be a brokered convention.
Yes.
Certainly could go one or more ballots without a nominee. I don't think the nominee is going to be chosen beforehand. Because
May I say something very quickly here, just to say something? Part of the problem is the way they divide the delegates, right? Because the way Republicans do it is sort of winner take all. So you get to a nominee, de facto nominee, very quickly. Even President Trump was a de facto nominee last time, and by July he was pretty much already in. But they go proportional, so you're right. It could be very much of a broker convention, and then, of course, what happens there? What's your guess?
Well, I don't know. I think the two so-called frontrunners are Biden and Warren. Bernie Sanders is on the up and up. Peter Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, is definitely on the rise. Mr. Yang is doing very well, starting to get measurable results. Mrs. Harris is not doing so well, but she's still getting a number of votes and could make a comeback. And one of the things I have stressed, in fact, the title of one of my recent pieces was Wait for the Voters. All we've had so far are pundits, commentators, media bias, polls, which are very inaccurate usually. We've had no expression of the actual voters who really are really not. The majority of them are probably not even engaged in the contest. So we have no idea who's going to be the nominee at this point. I mean, we have a general idea who it could be. We could have some new candidates. Mrs. Clinton, I think it's ridiculous for her to consider coming back in, but she could, and she still has some support out there, and that would complicate things. Michael Bloomberg was all set to run, and he has all the money in the world that he can spend, and he can get in as late as December or January and still get in the race and get delegates. And this Tom Steyer is spending a huge sum of money for his campaign and is getting some results. So, and the other thing that's made 2020 so different is that right after Iowa and New Hampshire, you've got a whole bunch of Super Tuesday states, which include California and Texas, but 12 other states, including Minnesota. So a whole bunch of delegates are going to be allocated on the same day. And since candidates can only be in one place at one time, and it's right after New Hampshire, candidates have to make up their minds which states they're going to compete in. And you could see the likelihood, not the certainty, but the likelihood that about 8 or 9 candidates could end up with delegates. And so that when they get even to the later primaries, where things are being divided up, we go into the convention with nobody close to 50%.
Right.
Even though somebody has a lead, like a Biden or a Warren, they still don't have enough delegates to win the nomination. And then you're going to have a lot of horse trading. And remember,
right,
this time, the superdelegates don't enter until the second ballot. Of course, they do enter in the second ballot. And if there's one ballot, it's indecisive. But even now, because of the way things are structured, the superdelegates are not likely to go with one candidate like they did last time with Mrs. Clinton. And as I pointed out earlier in the show, and I write about this often, it's a mistake to write off either Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders, because their base doesn't particularly care about all the foibles and shortcomings that everybody else is pointing out about these two candidates, their age and all that. They don't care. They want Biden or they want Sanders, and they're committed to that. And yes, their numbers are getting smaller because of the more and more candidates are being better known, but they're going to have a block of votes. So the outcome of the Democratic nomination contest is very uncertain 3 months out here.
Yeah, I think what is becoming more and more obvious to me, and you know, when I see these debates and when I see these candidates perform, I'm starting to agree more and more with you that this thing is far from certain. Now, where I may disagree slightly with you is that I think that there is a better chance of an independent breaking from the Democrat Party than a broker. Now, there may be a broker convention. That could happen. But I'm beginning to think more in terms of an independent, a Michael Bloomberg, for example, who says, you know what, I'm never going to win the Democrat nomination, so why waste my time running as a Democrat? Why not just go right as an independent, and then I can go one-on-one with President Trump? That's a possibility, and I think if Michael Bloomberg were to get in as an independent, I can see him doing quite well, actually, and he would hurt the Democrats, of course, but I think he could do very well in many states. It could almost turn into a Trump-Bloomberg race, Barry.
I don't think so. I'm
going
to disagree with you. I think that Bloomberg is committed to being, if not the nominee, which I don't think he can win, I think he wants to block Mrs. Warren from the nomination. He's always supported Biden. He's a more moderate figure. Bloomberg running as independent would guarantee Donald Trump's reelection.
Sure.
Not just, that would guarantee it. And so would any other significant independent candidate. So that's one of the reasons why Mr. Schultz withdrew. He wasn't particularly feeling well, but he also realized all he could do is be a spoiler and reelect President Trump. So I don't really think it's in the cards for an independent candidate. There'll be some independent candidate. There'll be a Green Party candidate. There'll be some. And they'll get some votes. But as you know, in a very close election, like there was in 2000,
yes,
Ralph Nader, with a couple million votes, decided the election.
That's right. Well, that's exactly right. Certainly in Florida.
Al Gore not only won the popular vote, if you take the Green Party out, I think he wins the Electoral College as well.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly wins Florida.
Right.
So the fact is, independent candidates are a problem for the Democrats for the most part. There's a few. There's a Constitution Party and a Libertarian Party. That's a problem for the Republicans. But I think that independent candidacies are kind of a quixotic endeavor and not
right,
likely to happen. So
let me
I
ask
will
you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish. Go ahead and finish.
No.
No, what I was going to say is that the way I look at it right now is that I see President Trump's political position at around 47-48% of the vote, pretty much where he ended the last time. And I don't think he's lost much of his support, maybe a few, but for the most part, I think he's got a loyal base that will give him roughly what he had the last time. And the question is, can a Democrat improve on what Mrs. Clinton did in some of these Midwestern states. That, to me, is sort of the key to the election, Barry. Do you agree with me?
Well, but the question is, yes, but the question is what kind of a nominee? So if the Democrats go to the left, especially if they go to either Bernie or Warren, where one is proclaiming himself a socialist, the other one, and claiming the other is not, but I can't tell the difference in most issues between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And if she's a capitalist, she's the strangest capitalist I know. She wants to, you know, tax all the money and redistribute all the wealth and have all these programs that you can't pay for. So if that's the kind of nominee the Democrats come up with, then I don't think the election is close. If they come up with a centrist, the election could be closer. Actually, Joe Biden is born in Pennsylvania, born in Scranton, and I think Biden probably takes to Pennsylvania in an election. Probably, or likely, not certainly. And that's an important state. Now, it is true that the Republicans are doing very well in Florida and Ohio, which are states that they need, but they're not doing so well in North Carolina and Georgia, which they won last time. On the other hand, the president is making an effort in Minnesota and New Hampshire and in North Carolina, New Mexico and Colorado and Nevada, which he lost. So everything is up in the air. I think the states of Florida, and you can speak to Texas. There's a lot of media speculation that Texas could go Democratic. I don't believe that.
No, I don't either.
And you know much more. I would listen to you because you're right there and you know. I think it's a lot of hype.
Mm-hmm.
But there are states that could go swing either way. It depends on what kind of a nominee you have and how effective they are. And remember, if you have a brokered convention, the Democrats meet at the end of July, so they have August, September, October, 3 months to get it together and to raise all the money they need. And remember, Mrs. Clinton outspent Trump 2 or 3 to 1
mm-hmm.
last time. And Trump has a huge organization. In fact, up here in Minnesota, he's already well into a very serious organization of his own. And he almost won in Minnesota without any organization. And now he's got a very effective organization with voter ID and get out the vote. And he's still the underdog in Minnesota, but he has a shot, a serious shot. And that's 10 electoral votes. So there's all kinds of combinations and strategies and possibilities, and it's still very early. And again, I
right.
go back no. to, again, my mantra, as I wrote, is wait for the voters. Let's
That's
see
right.
what the voters think.
Right.
I'm not going to be.
Well,
it could be a landslide for the Democrat. It could be a landslide for Trump. Or it could be very close. It could be anything, any possibility, because we don't know where the voters are, and we not only don't know where they are, but we don't know where they will be 15
right.
months from now.
Well, as you wrote in one of your recent articles, you know, go back to this time in 2015. I mean, we were doing shows in 2015, I remember, and I didn't even think back then that Donald Trump would be nominated by the Republicans, and you said something back then that you're sort of saying now. You said, let's wait for the voters. And the voters responded, and they obviously responded for Donald Trump, who eventually won the election. There's a lot of time ahead. There's a lot of balls in the air. And I still think that a lot of people are jumping to a lot of conclusions, and I know why they do it, because they've got shows or they've got deadlines to meet or whatever, articles and all of that they need to write. But I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen. I like your explanation. It could be a Democrat landslide. It could be a Republican landslide. It could be close. I'm probably in the category that it's going to be close, that Trump's going to win. But, you know, I could be wrong about that too, Barry.
Well, we don't know.
We don't know.
We have to wait for the voters.
That's right. We have to wait for the voters, and that just means that you and I have another reason to do a show.
Exactly.
Because we have to wait for the voters. Well, your Yankees did not make it. I thought it was a wonderful Game 6 when they lost to Houston, but I was hoping that game would go into extra innings, but it didn't anyway. But it was a great series, and the Yankees have a really good young team. I think they're going to be good for a while, Barry.
Right, and the Twins had a good team. They can't beat the Yankees, apparently.
Right.
In the postseason or even during the season, but they still had a good team themselves, and I don't know what the score is now, but it's the big Cinderella team is Washington, and they've won two games in Texas, and now they're
back
at their home field.
Well, they're at the moment the Astros are leading 4-1 in the seventh. So the Astros really need to win tonight. This is a desperate.
Yeah, they absolutely must.
Yeah, they have to win tonight. They don't want to go down 3-0 in that series. But the Astros are probably, in my opinion, they're the best team in baseball, the most complete team in baseball. So
well,
I would not.
We thought the Dodgers were a great team too, and look what
happened. Yeah, that's right. Well, the you're exactly right. The Dodgers, I think, had the best record in baseball, and they fell apart in the first round. But, you know, it's like, you know, baseball is unpredictable, just like politics is unpredictable. Barry, as always, thank you for your time. It's always a lot of fun to chat with you. And every time we chat, we exchange weather reports. And as I said at the beginning of the show, it's like 48, 49 here. And it's supposed to be about 44 in the morning. It's going to warm up a little bit in the afternoon tomorrow. But I think finally we got rid of summer, Barry.
I think we did.
All right, Barry. Thank you so much. Happy Halloween. If we don't chat before then, let's try to touch base again maybe toward the end of November.
We'll see how this impeachment process. One thing I wanted to say.
Yeah, go ahead,
impeachment is a purely political process. It's not a judicial process. Going back to 1867, when Johnson was impeached by the Republicans, political act. The Republicans tried to impeach Clinton, and the Democrats are trying to impeach Trump. It's a political act. It's not a judicial thing, and that's one of the reasons why it's such a high-risk process.
Well, let me ask you a question. Senator Graham just he has about 50 senators, I believe, in the Senate who are signed the resolution opposing the way the House is doing or going through the proceedings. The way that I interpreted that resolution is you've got 50 senators. If I'm a Democrat, what that's telling me is that they're going to have a heck of a time getting many Republicans to support them in a conviction of President Trump. So it's
I can only think of one possibility.
Yeah.
One Republican, that's Romney, and I bet that he doesn't. And at least two Democrats are not going to vote, the guy in Alabama and Angus King in Maine, who's basically an independent. And they got to have 67 votes. So they're going to have to pick up – they have 47. They're down to 45. So they're going to have to pick up 22 senators from the Republicans, which is almost half the delegation. And any Republican who votes to convict will be defeated in the next election.
Yeah, I don't expect any. I know Romney has been a little strange lately, but I don't even expect him to vote for conviction. I don't think he'll vote for conviction. But this resolution here that Senator Graham has just put together, I think that's a message to the Democrats that you can impeach him, but you're not getting very far.
And there may not be
USA.
A trial because, as Senator Byrd, the famous Democratic majority leader of years ago, during the Clinton impeachment, he moved to dismiss when the actual real impeachment, which was the indictment, came to the Senate. In the preliminaries, he moved to dismiss. And although that failed and there was a trial, the precedent was set that a motion to dismiss ends the whole process right away. So
that's interesting.
And McConnell has hinted that's exactly what he's going to do. He will move
to
dismiss.
And he's got the votes. All he needs is a majority for that, right?
51 votes.
Yeah, so
needs 50 because Pence is the 50th first vote.
Yeah, I'll just say one more thing about I'm glad you brought up the impeachment question. I think the Democrats are really overreaching with this, and especially the way they're doing it. If they had a vote and had a transparent impeachment, I think that might work better. But all this stuff in secret is simply emboldening the Trump base. And I don't think the Democrats are being very smart. I just think they're pandering to the left-wing base with all this impeachment, could backfire on them.
Nancy Pelosi, who I consider a very shrewd operator, is not allowing an actual impeachment vote. What she's got is an inquiry. And if she wants to prolong the inquiry, that's probably the smartest strategy because it produces headlines every day. But once you take a vote, it has to be a roll call vote, so everyone's on the record. And if you've got all those 30 or 30-some seats that were won by Democrats in Trump-won districts, you possibly could lose control of the House, which I don't think is in the cards right now, but it could happen if you proceed with impeachment.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, I think she's kind of playing. She wants to have it both ways here. She wants to talk about impeachment, but she really doesn't want to do it.
Well, if she can do it. But the problem is her base, her caucus base, which is AOC and Ilhan Omar and all the lefties, they want to have a vote. They want to impeach. And they don't particularly – I don't think they particularly care about the consequences.
No.
I think it's kind of their anti-Trump fervor, their delirium.
That's right. Yeah, and I think that that's exactly how it comes across. It comes across as just crazy delirium. That's exactly, I think, the way it's coming across to a lot of Americans. The other interesting thing, too, about the inquiry is that you can ask polling questions about the inquiry, which is entirely different than impeachment. So you can ask people, are you in favor of an inquiry? Well, I think a lot of people might say yes. But that and impeachment are two different things, Barry.
Well, and the other thing is, the overall polling is just like the polling for president. Do you actually favor impeachment? Yes, 52%, 53%. But that's the Democrats. But if you do it if you count the popularity or unpopularity of impeachment in the battleground states, you find that they're down 10 points. That the 10 points against it. And that's what counts. It's all about the Electoral College. It's not about the popular vote. So it's what the impact is in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, New Mexico, Colorado, those states which are the battleground states. What is the impact of impeachment there? That's all that really counts. Because those are the states which will determine the outcome of the 2020 election.
That's exactly right. Well, Barry, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time, and we will have to do this again maybe as we get closer to Thanksgiving or right after Thanksgiving in early December, because we'll be getting close then to Iowa by that time. We'll probably have more information on some of these.
We'll have a much clearer picture.
Yeah, at least clearer than it is now, because right now it's very much up in the air. Also, the impeachment thing will be a little perhaps further along. I'll make a prediction. I know you don't like to make predictions, but I'll make a prediction that they never actually take an impeachment vote. I'll make that prediction.
Okay.
I don't ever think that.
I'm not making a prediction.
No, okay, but I'll make it. I don't think they'll ever get to have an impeachment vote. I really don't think that that's ever going to happen. But thank you so much. I'll make a prediction that we're talking baseball next April.
Okay.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night, Barry. Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. We have a link to Barry's website on the show information. If you click on that, you'll be able to read about the Canadian election, the excellent article that he wrote, as well as some of the other wonderful articles that he writes about many things. You know, everyone I talk to, I always recommend that you get a subscription to the Prairie Editor, because it is really, in my opinion, one of the best ways of learning and being informed about American politics. So click on the link and go to the website and get yourself a subscription to the Prairie Editor. It is one of the very best sources out there in the political world. Thank you for listening. A little chilly tonight here in Dallas, Texas, but really not that out of the ordinary when you consider that we're talking almost late October. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.